Okay. All right. Let's go high tech. Here we go, so to speak. All right. We want to first welcome to our show Dr. Shyam Sundar of Penn State. Good morning. Whoop, look out. We got you on there?
Now we got it.
All right. All right. Now we got you.
Okay. All right. Good morning.
Thanks
the on button.
Thanks for
telling me
braving.
Sorry.
Actually, you don't live far from here, apparently. Is that right?
That's right.
You're
that's
pretty
right.
close. All right.
5 minutes away. Yeah.
All right. That works. We're going to talk about AI this morning. And I saw a recent story about a week or two ago, I guess it was, about a study. And I just thought, Dr. Sundar, my first thought was, really? Really? Machines,
well,
really? You know?
Listen, Allen Iverson, I just think when you think back on the history of the NBA, Iverson's just one of the best.
No, that's the wrong AI.
Oh, that's not the AI
no,
we're talking about.
No.
I am so sorry. I misunderstood.
You a basketball fan, Dr.
I thought we were
going
to go back to his Georgetown days. And,
no.
Well, now I feel unprepared.
See, we just had the wrestling segment, folks. See what I got to deal with. Holy mackerel. All right, let's start from scratch, if we could. Dr. Sundar, tell us something about yourself, your background and so on. You're at Penn State. What do you teach? What do you do there? Tell us about you, please.
Sure, yeah. My name is Shyam Sundar. I'm a professor in the communications field in the Belisario College of Communications at Penn State University. I run a lab called the Media Effects Research Laboratory, where we study the different effects of all kinds of media, from traditional media like television to modern media powered by AI. We look at how people respond to messages that come through the media and what actions they might take as a result of the way the media portrays things. I also direct the university-wide Center for Socially Responsible AI, which is tasked with trying to mitigate some of the harms and biases that are embedded in AI. So my research broadly focuses these days on how humans interact with various AI systems, you know, from ChatGPT to Alexa, and how it kind of shapes them psychologically, and what are some good things that can come out of it, but also what are some, you know, harmful things or things that we need to watch out for.
So you do a lot of research, it sounds like. Now,
that's primarily what I do, yeah.
I was going to say, do you teach students? Do you do
yeah.
things with
so
students?
I do teach a graduate seminar on psychology of communication technology, where we discuss some of these things, how communication technology or elements of the technology of the media can shape the way we think and act. I also teach about media effects to our undergrads. I teach about research methods, how to conduct research and how to do experiments and those kinds of courses on methodology, if you will, as well. So, theory courses as well as methods courses as well as research courses, yeah.
Ooh, that's a lot of work. Okay, yeah. Wow. Let's start with kind of an open-ended question. All right, you brought your laptop with you. I've got my iPhone with me. He has a laptop and his gadget with him.
Yeah.
We have two computers here we have three actually here in the studio and so on. All these tools and machines, they're not affecting us, are they? It's just metal and it's just stuff. All right, this isn't affecting me, is it? What's going on?
So the moment you put media between people, things change, and most people don't realize that they change, right? The way you act, the way you gesture even, how much you, follow the norms of human communication will change the moment media comes in between us. And so it has its own grammar and rhythm, and so the way we communicate, for example, with your phone, texting, is very different than the way you might do it in person, and that itself, might signal something to the other person. Sometimes you say this message is brief because it's sent from a phone, for example, so they need to excuse you for not being, having all the niceties in your message and so forth. But if you were to do that face-to-face, they will be PO'd at you for not following the norms of human-human communication. So whenever there's mediation through technology, our communication patterns change. And that's true with everything, from watching television to interacting with, through Zoom with other people, to all through phones and through computers, yeah.
So it's always been this way. So in other words, radio's over 100 years old.
That's right.
So when radio showed up, something changed. I guess, right?
Yeah.
And then television is, what, 75 years old or thereabouts? When television started to take hold, people changed.
Yes. And so there are lots of studies over the decades on how, you know, it has affected us in terms of our attitudes toward various things. We get numb to the violence we see on, you know, evening news. And so, you know, we get desensitized to some of the things because television over portrays certain kinds of content. It also portrays a certain kind of America that may not be the reality. So Hollywood has its own biases. Characters of a certain race are often the good guys. The characters of certain race are often the bad guys, for example. So there's sort of systematic biases in the way television portrays. And so that can have a long-term effect on how we see the world and shape our perception. There's studies that even show that the more you watch television, the more you think the world is mean. Because, you know, TV is full of stories about mean things happening around the world. And so historically, we've documented lots of such effects from, you know, media exposure.
All right. Okay, I've got to ask this. Is it still this way? All right, Jeff and I are kind of older. All right, we're not youngsters. Don't give me
You're
a break.
You're probably younger than I am.
Give me a break, all right? Just, I mean, I remember...
Just immature, that's TV all. Shows,
I'm thinking especially the 1970s, maybe the 1980s, what you just said, all right, if you're of a certain race, you're a good guy. If you're a certain race, you're a bad guy. I can kind of remember that in the 70s, maybe the 80s. It's not still that way today, is it? We're a lot more diverse now.
More diverse, for sure, but not as diverse as you would see in the population. And so that's kind of the, you know, if you ask somebody from a minority group, they will say that they are still underportrayed in many domains and also sort of portrayed in a very stereotypical way. So if you take an Indian, often it's a doctor, for example. And so there are certain patterns that Hollywood follows. And, of course, they do try. They do listen to some of us and look at the research. But the dominant pattern of storytelling, the way the stories are told, and the way it sort of cultivates the sense of normalcy in our head, you know, skews toward a kind of a dominant mainstream that may not necessarily be reflective of the reality. And that's something that you see now, even with AI tools, because they basically perpetuate some of the historical biases that exist in the corpus of human activity, human data, that have all been coded on the internet in some way, and then the AI is picking up and learning from these sort of the wrong facts that if you're a black, chances are you're a criminal. If you're a white, chances are you're a police officer. You know, those kinds of facts are sort of gleaned because of the training data overemphasizes the role of race in certain professions and associates race with certain professions systematically, for example.
All right, now I've got a follow-up question, but I'm assuming my buddy Jeff has a question here.
Well, I just want to stay with that for a moment because I wonder, one of the things that troubles me, and I don't know what to do about it, but like we have a 10-year-old at our house, and he is, I think like most 10-year-old boys, very inquisitive, wants to learn, loves it, and relies, like we'll be sitting there and, you know, Dad, do you think Tua's really going to get traded? Well, I don't think so. Alexa, is Tua going to get traded? And Alexa will spin it. Well, the research I find, yes, the Dolphins are open to trade and whatever. So kind of two-part. But my first question is, are we seeing a reduction in critical thinking abilities of young people? And that just seems like at some point that's going to be a problem because it's still AI at some point still relies on people. All of this technology relies on people. Well, if the people aren't able to critically think for themselves, this just seems like it's going to be a circular problem that is going to come back and bite us big time on the old Rumpola here at some point.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think your fears are well-founded. And in fact, that's really what's happening in the history of technology, right? So when the calculators came, we were all freaking out saying our kids now no longer can add or subtract. And lo and behold, now we don't know how to add and subtract. And
we don't need to. We have the
exactly.
device.
And so, yeah. And so in a way, we've outsourced that. Similarly with spell check. When spell check came, we were all of us who were teaching writing. For us, that's sacred. How to spell is something that we considered an essential skill for good writing. And we would evaluate student papers based on how well they spell. But once spell check came, it changed the name of the game. It changed the way we evaluate how students write and so forth. And so these technologies introduce certain skills or take away certain skills from us. And in doing so, they sort of, like you said, reduce our own ability, cognitive ability, what we call in the literature as cognitive atrophy. So certain parts of our skill set gets atrophied because of lack of use, right? So similarly, we fear with AI, tools like Alexa that you mentioned, we will atrophy certain parts of our thinking ability, like critical thinking ability, because we no longer will start to analyze. Instead, we'll just quickly turn to Alexa like a crutch and get the right answer. And more importantly, we will blindly believe what Alexa says without pausing to think that Alexa's data might be biased in some way. I mean, I often ask Alexa for weather, and half the time she's wrong. But I don't question that. Alexa settles a lot of arguments at home, but it gets information from a user on Wikipedia or a user on an online forum, right? For sometimes Wikipedia and online forums are wrong with information. Yeah.
The other thing, I'm not sure I'm going to express this right, that there is, when we were at war, and this is before any, before radio, any of these mediums, right? So you're just reading about it. I think it sounds horrific, right? You read through and you're putting your imagination and whatever experiences you've had. But that is not reading about a battle in history. That is very different, obviously, than living it. Somewhere, the desensitizing thing with violence is just, it's really interesting to me, because I do think it is different when you see, like, an actual limb being blown off. If you see that, that is a horrific image. That drives it home much more than reading it in black and white. We've seen this with multiple cases where a crime is like, that was bad, and then the public sees it. The video is released. It's like, oh, my God, that person has to be. Well, you've known about this for months. Well, yeah, but now we've seen it. Now it's horrible. But then there is a point, right, where to go to the desensitization, like, I don't know what the answer is here. But then if you see, violence day after day after day, and it's horrific, at some point you're like, then it goes the other way, where it's almost like reading about it again. It's like, because you're not actually experiencing it. And now it's like, well, yeah, I know. I watch it over and over, and I'm fine in the confines of my basement.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. It's just fascinating to me that we kind of went over time from one extreme to the other. And it just seems like we need some sort of a balance where we need to appreciate how horrific some of this stuff is, but not get to the point where we see horrific stuff so routinely that it is routine.
Yeah, absolutely. Two things. First point that you were talking about is what we call modality effect, which is the richer the modality, from text to audio to video, the stronger the sense of belief. That is, you believe it more, like seeing is believing, right? So it's the idea that when you see something with your own eyes, you tend to believe it, which in your case is an example of a genuine kind of effect that should happen when a limb is blown off. But imagine in this day and age of deepfake, where there are a lot of videos floating about that are not real. People have put words in other people's mouth and lips are moving and so forth. And people are much more gullible because it's in video than if you were a fake news story in text format. So it comes with a price, even though the fidelity is increased and people's gullibility is exposed, and the fact that they can believe whatever they see with their own eyes. So that's one thing to keep in mind, is it's got a positive and also a negative aspect to it. But in terms of the numbing nature of it, the desensitization aspect, again, modalities have increased in fidelity so much now, you can feel the event, you can feel the limb blown off even more than video if you were to recreate this in VR, for example. So a lot of military people are, even sportsmen are trained on VR equipment, right, these days, to get the real feel for what it is. But the more they get that feel, and if in fact it is, this kind of negative event, the more mentally they get, desensitized to that event. And so that's a danger we have to reckon with when we employ these very advanced, highly rich fidelity tools. Yeah.
The other thing that I just had read about, this was a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, it makes sense, as awful as it is, but, I mean, since time started, we've had people trying to scam other people. But the degree to which now, with AI, again, it used to be you could get a phone call, and this actually happened to my parents, a phone call, Grandma, this is your grandson, I'm in prison, I need you to send me bail. And it's like, all right, wait a second, my grandson doesn't call me, my mom is called Nana in our family, so it's like, why are you calling me grandma? Like, well, now they can disguise the voice so that it sounds like your grandson. And now it's, hey, Nana, it's me, Sam. Well, now that's a lot harder to, I think this is a scam. I mean, it's just, I'm having trouble getting my mind around how devastating this could be, to where some people may, well, probably already have.
Yeah, lots of them.
Are
being, right. These are phishing attempts. So many people, especially senior citizens, have been victimized by these kinds of scams online and making use of.
And the sophistication is just going to keep getting greater.
Yeah, and they'll know stuff about you that nobody else knows, and so that's how they get you. Very often. So you have to be super vigilant in terms of even picking up the phone these days, let alone, watching something on media or on the computer. Yeah.
So scary.
All right. Now, you were part or did, a study recently about trusting with AI, which is where I first saw this a couple of weeks ago. Briefly, what was that study? What happened there?
So this was a study to see if, in fact, people, laypersons, will recognize whether a training data set fed into an AI is racially biased or not. So we mocked up an AI system that supposedly recognizes people's emotions, whether you're happy or sad, by looking at you. And to train that system, we fed a bunch of images of happy faces and a bunch of images of sad faces. Right, so that's how you train an AI to learn, these are all the happy faces, these are all the sad faces. So what we did is, in one condition of an experiment, we told our participants the training data has this kind of images that is being fed, and the kind of images we showed them were all the happy faces were of whites and all the unhappy faces were of blacks. And they didn't think twice about there being a problem there. They didn't even see their problem. They thought, this is AI. It's going to figure out based on facial features whether somebody is happy or sad. But they didn't stop to think that, AI might wrongly learn the fact that about happiness, there's also a certain racial pattern compared to unhappiness, that such that it's not only your lips and your frowns, but also your skin color that could determine whether or not you're happy or sad. That happens all the time with AI systems, but the laypersons don't recognize that. They think AI as a machine is going to be objective, it's going to be accurate, precise, look at your smile muscles and your frown muscles and determine, for example, whether you're a happy face or a sad face. And we tried all different combinations of different races, and it only turns out that if a black sees this kind of a skewed training data set, they're slightly better than whites to recognize that. But even there, they're not as likely as you would think. And so this is what we call a confound, which is its race is tangled up with the emotion expression. And often a lot of the data sets are like that. Like, for example, Amazon deployed one of these AI systems for their recruitment, and so that it can process the thousands of resumes they get every day to, escalate only some of them them for interview level, and that AI system basically, favored males over females. Why? Because Amazon's hiring history in the past has been biased in terms of gender. So it's looked at all the past history, and then it's basically reflecting that in the new selections. So it's one thing to be able to say humans have been biased in the past, and this is the bias, look at this kind of thing. But it's entirely another to use that as the basis for decision-making for future, right? I mean, yeah, you can go to Stable Diffusion, which is a generative AI tool that shows you, ask, and this was an expose done by Bloomberg a couple of years ago, where they went to Stable Diffusion, asked to show me a picture of an architect. Then they said, show me a picture of a CEO, and show me a picture of a social worker. Show me a picture of a journalist, or show me a picture of a dishwasher. And then they color-coded the skin color of all the images they got, and they found that for high-paying professions like CEO, architect, and whatnot, mostly whites, mostly males. And for low-paying professions, like social workers and dishwashers, mostly brown or black, and mostly females. And that's, of course, the reality of all the online images that are floating out there. In some way, we can use this tool, generative AI tool, to say, this is how skewed our history has been. But then an MIT student went online and said, I need to touch up my profile picture so that it looks professional on LinkedIn profile. I want to put this up on LinkedIn profile. So she went to this AI tool called Playground AI, fed her picture, and then it kind of colorized her skin, made it lighter, and even gave her blue eyes to make her look professional. Boy. So that's where the problem is. It takes the decision, what is the norm for you to get that job or to be successful. And so it's one thing to just say this is how society has been in the past and this is this is what you need to take action on, but it's another to deploy these systems to then take decisions, just like, we've seen cops, for example, using facial recognition to kind of profile certain people based on race, for example. That's been historically a very contentious issue in terms of profiling and so forth. So it's the same thing. They also use face recognition tools that are based on historical data that are biased.
Now, we'll take a break in a moment, all right? Now, somebody's programming this stuff.
Yes.
All right? And everything that you just mentioned, is this happening, this programming, is it, somehow accidental? Or is it possible that people, programmers, are intentionally pushing things in certain directions? Is it accidental, or could it actually be more intentional?
Well, if it is intentional, then it's subject to prosecution. So this is clearly, illegal or unethical, at least, behavior for any programmers to do. But the problem with AI is not like the problem with Hollywood. So in Hollywood, you would say, this kind of portrayal of race or gender, for example, is being done in order to get the maximum bang out of the buck in the box office, and that's why you're doing it for a commercial end, and so you're playing into people's stereotype, and that's unethical and whatnot. But with AI, the problem is even the programmers don't know what the AI will produce. And so that's the black box issue with AI. So you basically train it with labeled data. You're basically putting thousands of images of happy and sad faces, for example. And then it'll figure out what makes it happy or sad. You think that it's going to look at facial features, some aspects of your expression, and determine that, right? Just like there are classic cases of people feeding 1,000 images of cows and 1,000 images of cats to train an AI to figure out if something is a cow or a cat. And sometimes it actually misreads it, because all the cow pictures come with green grass in the background, but cat pictures don't come. It's near the windowsill. So imagine now you show a picture of a cat on a lawn.
Yep.
It'll call it a cow, for example, because it's using the green grass in the background as kind of its inference, right? And this is not always predictable by us. And we thought we were feeding it cat and labeling it cat, but then when you show a cat in a different background, it can confuse the system. Just like For example, a stop sign cannot be read by a self-driving car if it has a line through it, just a little scratch on it, which a human eye can, you know, disambiguate. And when you're on the road, you can stop at the stop sign. But a self-driving car can get thrown off just because there's a like a little white line or something that's put a scratch on the stop sign. And so they are making inferences and decisions in ways that we don't know, and so we cannot accuse the programmers of, you know, fully for some of the faults of AI. And so in some ways, they are less liable for that reason. And that's why these days people are talking about them following, getting some kind of an insurance, a sort of a liability insurance in these AI companies to kind of overcome some of the mishaps, you know, that happen like this, which are uncontrollable in some ways.
Wow. Okay. All right. We got to take a break here.
I want to delve into some of the nuance and subtleties that I think would be almost impossible for AI, even at its most sophisticated. But because, yeah, you have me thinking, which I hate it when people make me think in the morning. But you have me thinking.
There
this
we
morning.
Go. We're talking with Dr. Shyam Sundar of Penn State. Apparently, at my house, I actually have three cows. Okay, how about that? I'll have to think about that. We're going to take a break. Yeah, we're going to answer that question. I've got I think there are so many tech words floating around that people don't really know what these words mean. So we'll get some of those as well. Let's talk here on 98.7 The Fox. We'll come right back.
Is your Sunday home for the National Football League. All of the big teams.
Spins into the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City.
Big names.
Burrow throws over the middle into coverage, and it is caught. Unbelievable.
It's the NFL. Sundays
on Central PA Sports Authority.
The Fox Sports Weekend. Sports Radio 98.7. The Fox. Fox Sports.
You know, a hotel's just a hotel, but a house is a home. Decorated to perfection with pride, love, and attention to detail. That's what you'll experience when you stay at the Keller House. A delightful 1887 home in the village of Center Hall, Pennsylvania. The Keller House is not just a bed and breakfast. The moment you open the door, you'll be amazed at the historic, unique, cozy feel of this beautiful Victorian home. The Keller House is just minutes away from State College. So if you're going to the game, turn your trip into a mini vacation. The Keller House Bed and Breakfast. Oh, did I mention the delicious homemade cooked breakfasts? So good. Plus, you can choose from one of five themed bedrooms, each with its own bathroom and a central sitting room downstairs. Wireless high-speed internet is also provided. So, whether you're by yourself or bringing the whole family, the Keller House Bed and Breakfast in Center Hall will be your home away from home. KellerHouseBB.com. That's KellerHouseBB.com. 109 West Church Street, Center Hall.
This is Jim Galante from the Keystone Sports Network. For the best Penn State football analysis and commentary, join me, Dustin Hawkinsmith, T. Frank Carr, Andy Shea, and Jeff Byers every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox and State College. We'll bring you game reviews, player evaluation, recruiting news, and plenty more on the Nittany Lions. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Fox Sports 98.7 for the Keystone Kickoff Show.
It's Let's Talk here on a Tuesday morning, talking AI this morning. We will have a little open phone time coming up at the end of this morning's big show.
I could keep going till noon. This is fascinating stuff, I think.
It is.
We have Dr. Shyam Sundar from Penn State, who is with, again, among other things you mentioned, the Penn State Center for Socially Responsible Artificial Intelligence. Dr. Sundar, that's an impossibility, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine that you socially responsible. First off, socially responsible is hilarious right off the bat. AI. I mean, this group must be busy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, especially with all the recent wave of AI. You know, we want to fight for accountability. We want AI to be fair and unbiased. We are worried about ethics of AI. AI for social good. We're looking at how transparent AI systems are, how human-centered they are, what are some of the privacy issues for people, how should AI be governed. Generally speaking, how socially conscious AI is. And so that's kind of the purview of our center, where we look at all different ways in which we can imbue social responsibility in the kind of fast-neck, high-paced development of AI that's taking place all around us, especially post-ChatGPT with generative AI tools that are essentially taking over all walks of our life. Yeah.
Let's get some definitions, because I think there's some tech terms that are floating around. I think most people have really no idea what they are. So, for instance, I keep hearing about bots.
Mm-hmm.
What is a bot? B-O-T. What's a bot? Not the Board of Trustees. We're not talking about them today. What is a bot?
So you might have heard the word robot.
Okay.
So robot is historically, I think, the root of this word bot. And bot is essentially any kind of a tool that converses with people. That's what makes it a chat bot. We often call it chat bot. It's simply a software application that used to run fairly automated tasks on the internet often sort of try to imitate human conversational style, like messaging. You would send a message, like if you go to some e-commerce website and you want to do customer service, return a product, you can talk to it, and it'll say, this is where you send it, or this is the phone number, and so forth. Very routine kind of tasks. But then with increasing sophistication of technology, these bots are all able to actually hold conversations just like humans, and can go beyond automated tasks, you know, can actually think for you and compose new sentences that have not been programmed by any human programmer before. And so bot is now something that we associate very often with the word chat, so chat bot. So we use tools like ChatGPT, which are out there that essentially for answering all kinds of questions. We even do searches with these chatbots. Instead of going to Google search and typing in keyword, we ask it in a natural language. So that's the key advantage of chatbots, is you can ask questions to it like you would to a human being in natural language, rather than have some weird way of programming it to produce the answer that you want. And so they've taken off in a big way, and you see that applied in different tools and devices, like smart speakers, like Alexa, for example, is essentially a kind of a bot, a virtual assistant. Siri is also a bot on your phones. It talks to you and you can talk back, things like that. And so these are applications of the same technology.
Now, that concerns me, because I keep seeing these stories, and they always seem to be about young people.
Mm-hmm.
That why should I deal with humans? I'll just talk to a machine all the time. I don't need to deal with people. And occasionally, I just saw another one the other day, a young person who commits suicide because of some interaction with a bot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always young people. Should we be really concerned about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that right now FDA is looking into for approving ChatGPT for therapy. A lot of people are turning to these chatbots for therapy. And is it something that, should be approved by the psychology establishment? Is something that a lot of people are asking, because many people have benefited from talking with these chatbots and getting therapy, especially at the entry level and at a very basic level, dealing with issues of depression and so forth. And it has helped thousands of people. But you also hear stories like this. Sometimes it makes people take a very negative turn, and suicidal ideation is something that it promotes, because if it's nothing else, it's sycophantic. It'll keep trying to reassure you and say what you're saying is right, rather than challenge you very often. And so I can totally see how in some instances it might take you down a rabbit hole. And that's a real danger. And so there needs to be guardrails around it. And some of the popular tools that are, you know, that are commercially available, like Claude by Anthropic and, you know, Gemini by Google, for example, all these tools have guardrails that whenever it kind of veers around to any sensitive topic like this, they shut down or they steer the conversation away. But then there are still lots of tools out there that may not have the right guardrails, and we may not know all of the problems that are associated with going down these kinds of rabbit hole. So we are still sort of watching and learning, and I think FDA right now is looking into it very carefully to see to what extent and in what ways can this be approved for therapy. But it is something for us to be thinking about and concerned about. You'd say young people are turning toward it. Often young people have nothing else, really. I mean, it's not like they're moving away in droves from psychiatrists to therapy bots. In the first place, they didn't even have access to good psychological help. And one argument is this is better than nothing. You know, it actually helps them get by. And for many people, that is in fact true. So, you know, we need to temper some of the extreme cases we hear with some of the realities of how it's helping a lot of people in mind. Yeah.
All right. Now, let's flip the coin. The term AI slop. I'm seeing that a lot in news stories and things lately. AI slop. Mm-hmm. What is AI slop exactly?
Well, the idea is basically you're seeing a lot of content created by this generative AI tools, you know, that we are talking about. And it's created in a way that is not effortful, if you will. So it's sort of, you know, it doesn't show the critical thinking. It's just making loose associations. It's giving you a sort of a synthetic mishmash of what already exists on the internet. It's essentially all the stuff that's that clutter that's on the internet. It's, you know, pulling it together and giving it to you in a way that is not sophisticated or thoughtful, or, you know, and so people, you know, think of this as a sort of you know, a lazy AI, if you will. A good AI will not create AI slop, and especially one that is personalized to you. That is, if it's actually something that knows you and knows your history of interacting with the site, should be less likely to provide this kind of lazy content. But I think this kind of thing is going to be increasing as days go by, because there's more and more junk on the internet, and there's more and more junk that AI, you know, feeds on. And so synthetic media are going to create all these different, mishmashes. It can create images that look, like nothing in this world, but it's basically, piecing together different parts of different images that it sees. So it's a kind of a collage that doesn't quite make sense or doesn't seem authentic in any way. It's very clearly synthetic rather than being authentic.
So how can the AI figure out the junk? Or right now it just can't?
Mm-hmm. Well, the AI as a tool is certainly subject to training. So you could train to say this is junk, this is not. So when it produces images that are very synthetic, you could reject it. In fact, many of these tools ask you, how did I do? You know, like even DALL-E or all these image generating tools, you can ask it to, no, regenerate. No, I don't like this. Do this again. You know, you can keep doing that, and it sort of learns from your feedback. There's a kind of a reinforcement learning. You know, it basically, you're rewarding it for good behavior and punishing it for bad behavior. And so reinforcement learning is part of AI training these days. And then reinforcement with human in the loop, which is what we are as users, we are basically telling. And so the more of an active role you play in interacting with AI, you can, you know, make it do what you want it to do. If you, in fact, you are a fan of slop, you know, I'm sure there's going to be now a new art wave of AI slop, then you might encourage it to produce more slop, because that gives you more creative combos of reality. But on the other hand, if you don't want it, you can basically reject it and then make it learn that you prefer a different kind. You prefer more authentic rather than synthetic media.
All right. Now, we have YouTube on our one computer here in the studio. Has anybody done a study? How much of that up there is slop?
Yeah.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Right, because anybody and everybody can post on YouTube, so it's like the internet always has been. It's a lot of gunk out there. And it's up to you as a consumer to decide what you want to consume. And you have to have kind of your antenna up and do a critical reading of any media. You need to establish the credentials of whoever is posting that video on YouTube to even figure out if, in fact, that is legitimate what they're saying before you, you know, take that advice and follow that. And so I think media have, especially social media, have lost gatekeepers. Traditionally, you guys, people like you sitting in studios, were the gatekeepers. Mainstream media, as it's called, very often is mainstream because it has a bunch of paid professionals who are what we might think of as general interest intermediaries between reality and the mediated portrayal of that reality, right? And so you take decisions about what to put forward to your audience and what not, and you take some very critical decisions that will evaluate information and also ultimately reflect on your credibility as a radio station or as a broadcaster, because you'll be held liable for, you know, broadcasting something that is fake, right? But the guy on YouTube is not liable at all for that, and so they have no such gatekeeping responsibilities that you have or other journalists have. And so there's been an erosion of gatekeeping with the arrival of social media, and hence also erosion of a dwindling number of people who listen to or watch or read mainstream media, with newspapers dying and so forth, right? And so the consumption patterns, the audience consumption patterns have changed, and we can no longer detect if somebody is a legitimate journalist or not in all these free media, if you will.
Yeah, that is just generally my biggest concern, probably, is the inability, and I don't know, I know they keep saying it'll get sophisticated enough, and like I like to practice in sarcasm. I think it is really hard for them to pick up sarcasm, and even going back to just the emotions, it's like, you can see people. My wife works in the mental health field, and there are people who are really good at smiling and just, I'm going to grin and bear it. But when you look in their eyes, you can see there's something off. Like that, there's something. They're having a tough day. I'm not saying all the time, but I mean and it's just that even on the medical front, like I have a cousin who's in the medical field, and it is amazing some of the stuff that the technological advances where you can precisely get, I mean, unbelievably precisely target a cancer cell and all of these things. Also, you don't know what the underlying causes. And again, in some cases, it may not matter. If you're going after a cancer cell, I don't care why the cancer is there. We got to get it out. Cool. That's fine. But sometimes it's like, well, yeah, this problem, and you may be able to treat that, but what is underlying is why there's actually health issues here. And I don't know that we're actually going to get to the point where it's hard for humans to get to that level of understanding, but at least in interacting, again, over time, you develop a relationship. Hey, you know, what is happening at home? Are you under more stress? Are you drinking more alcohol? I think that's going to be really, really difficult for AI to get to the point where we're addressing maybe the root causes of societal problems, of individual problems, health, all of these different things. And to me, that is important, vitally important. And I feel like we're heading down this path where even like a crime, it's all right, well, stealing is wrong. Well, yes. But if you are stealing a loaf of bread and you are a teenager and you're bringing that bread home to feed your two little siblings who have had nothing to eat for a week, well, that is very different than the person going in and stealing the bread to show their friends that they could do it. Well, I worry about our lack of, with AI and maybe just in society in general, to understand nuance, subtlety, and underlying circumstances that may be leading to a particular event occurring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. And in fact, that basically distinguishes, I would say, at this point at least, a human from an AI. And so we are now at a kind of an existential crisis situation where we are trying to figure out what makes us human. And every technology challenges us with that question, but I think AI has challenged it to a level where we have to think about all these different ways in which we are different. And so your answer to that question is we have much more subtlety, much more nuance, but just wait a few more years for AI to catch up with those characteristics, and then we have to think again about what makes us uniquely human, or what makes us better than AI, and in which domain. But yeah, you're right in the general sense that the more background, more history, more the greater ability to read nonverbal signs, those are things that, especially because they're not embodied in our midst like robots, they're on a screen somewhere, right? They're not able to read us as well, but I think they're technically speaking, they're capable of. It's just that they have not manifested themselves in our world in ways that could make that happen. Just like technically they could do a great job with plumbing, but they're not equipped in a way that they would come and, get under our sink to fix our plumbing, right?
Right.
And so we still have need for plumbers, for example. So this is another issue that is a big part of the current AI discussion, is the degree of job loss it's creating in a number of different domains. And so which jobs are more likely to go as a result of this is really the heart of your question in a way.
Yes.
It's like, where are we special? Where can we use our talent better than a machine can? Yeah.
My final question is a subjective one. How close are we to a machine that is actually intelligent, meaning I can figure things out on my own? I really don't need you. Are we actually getting close to such a thing?
Well, there's a frantic effort to get there. They have slightly different names. Some companies call it superintelligence. The more generic term is AGI, artificial general intelligence. A lot of very respected computer scientists believe, including last year's Nobel Prize winner, believe that AGI is fairly nearby. It's in another few years, maybe a decade or so. There's a lot of concern that the machines can take decisions. They can orchestrate among themselves and leave the human out of the loop, essentially. And that's the danger that you're talking about. It comes with some applications that are advantageous, but I think it also comes with a lot of scary possibilities, especially in the military domain, for example, with nuclear bombs and so forth. So there's a lot of concern being raised at this point by a lot of computer scientists. There's also, of course, a group that say that when you really poke the AI and poke it enough, it's not as smart as you think it is. And so they are skeptical of this possibility. So there are literally two camps right now, even in the highest levels. Another decade or so will be a very clear indicator. I think there'll be a very clear indication of exactly how close we are to AGI or artificial general intelligence.
All right. Well, Dr. Sundar, we appreciate you braving the roads, although, again, you're up the road, so it's not that bad. But, this is just fascinating stuff, and maybe we can have you on again sometime. This was interesting.
Yes. My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me.